our guest today kind of builds off our episode we had 2 weeks ago with journalist Roan Tempest, a discussion of the media and their role in the long war and communicating exactly what is going on both directly and indirectly outside of our borders, especially for those that report with our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines on the front line. That's essential. For those that actually have been in this line of work in the past or presently are, they can sometimes read through the lines and have an idea, but the vast majority of the people out there, even if they have family members in the service, they really have trouble getting a firm grasp of what's going on. And that's why it is so essential for those journalists that are out there who have the responsibility of sometimes in just a two-minute time slot to try to give the public an idea of what their neighbors, their men and women who they live with or their family members are overseas, what is trying to be accomplished and what's progressing. And they smell the hazards. They live day in and day out and do their best to report it. And our guest today, I think, is perfect to build off what we did with Roan. She's presently Associated Press Intelligence and Counterterrorism Correspondent, Kimberly Dozier. Formerly, she was a foreign correspondent with CBS News. She specializes in the Middle East, from the disputed territories of Israel to the war in Afghanistan and the hunt for Osama bin Laden. She reported on the war in Iraq from its beginning in 2003 until she was injured by a car bomb in 2006. She has continued to work since then and has recently returned from Afghanistan. She also has experience as the London Bureau Chief for CBS Radio News. She's received four Gracie Awards and a Peabody Award, including one for her body of work in Iraq. And you can also find her writing over at the Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle. And she's been featured on things as varied as CBS Primetime and Glamour Magazine. She's also the author of Breathing the Fire, Fighting to Survive and Get Back to the Fight. Just came out in paperback. It's a story of her recovery from her injuries in 2006. Kim, welcome to Midwest.
Hey, great to be here. And got to point out, the book is coming out with its profits going to Wounded Warrior charities, like one that's close to you, Wounded Wear, run by Lieutenant Jay Redman, Navy SEAL. Just trying to pay it forward for all those people who put me back together.
That's so important, and I think everybody appreciates that, the fact that they can do two things at once. They can help get a little deeper perspective of what people go through and also give to a good cause. We've done some things with Soldiers Angels here on the show as well, and there's lots of some great organizations out there that are helping people. And in your specific line of work, I think the Chinese have a great phrase, may you live in interesting times. And obviously, reporting on national security issues in that part of the world has always been interesting. But in the last 10 years, it's really been nonstop. The focus may have changed, whether you're looking at people going up the Kandahar plain from Camp Rhino in the early, late parts of 2001, early 2002, through the height of the Iraq conflict, and, to where we are now as we're trying to figure out the whole AFPAC arena. As somebody who's been deeply involved, both personally and with people you work with, in reporting the war and the international diplomatic implications of it, how do you feel that we, and I mean we as in the West, have been evolving the way that we communicate to our publics on what exactly is going on and what the future may hold for the issues that they're reading about today?
I have to say a lot of the reporting has gotten smarter, a little bit more educated about things military, and I can speak to that from tough experience in the field. 2003, 2001, the reporters going into the field to cover the military, to cover war, many of them did not have a clue about the beast that they were about to try to get to know, which is the way the U.S. military works in the field And I say that from personal experience because my dad was a World War II Iwo Jima era Marine, survived that fight, never spoke about the military at home. So I didn't know what the ranks were. I didn't know what is an army, a brigade combat team, knew none of that. And all of a sudden, there I am in Iraq, responsible for covering that story. And I went through an evolution, an education, and I saw fellow reporters and also the military folks that we were covering go through the same thing. I can describe it in stages, if you bear with me.
Please.
First, there's the stage of you are warily circling each other, don't know much about each other's way of life, why you do what you do. And I saw a lot of suspicion, especially suspicion among the, you get the young officers and you get the young kind of East Coast educated reporters from, I don't know, the big newspapers, big radio stations, and it was like watching bulls fighting. Like at press conferences, the snippy little comments back and forth, these people did not like each other. And then the next stage is they start to get to know each other. The reporters start embedding, start going through some of the same close calls, get to know, oh, that's how you close the door on a Humvee. Oh, that's what you do when you get into a helicopter. Oh, that's the difference between a Black Hawk and a Chinook. And now I understand some of the ranks, and I understand that the NCO Corps is what keeps the whole thing running. I got it. And here's the problem. The military officers also and the NCOs get to know the troop, get to know some of the reporters, good. But you get a little, as a reporter, case officered by your subject. I'm borrowing from what I cover now, the CIA. That's when you're suddenly you're part of the cool kids club, and you know what the jargon is, and you know how to wear your flak jacket, and you know not to bleed your flashlight at night when you're on an operation, and you start falling a little in love with your subject, and you look the other way when maybe you shouldn't. And then something pulls you up short. Maybe it's another media organization saw something in a unit that you were embedded with and you missed, or maybe as a news organization you pulled your punches on something small, and then you maybe held back a piece of possibly damaging video, and then you saw that unit you were covering commit something worse down the line, and you realize, what the heck am I doing? I'm here for them. I'm here for the American public. This is my job to be tough, to be the American public's inspector general in the field. And I'm not here to be your cheerleader. That's what the Pentagon Channel is for, some of the outlets on there. I am supposed to be holding people's feet to the fire the same way a good officer, sergeant, major, chief holds his troops' feet to the fire. And you go through that whole evolution. The military folks I've found who've watched me go through that evolution, and I've come out with some harsh stories, and I've gotten an attaboy for harsh stories, those are the people that, well, I've stayed friends with and have respect for because they understand, love the military, but I'm also doing my job.
How much of a I look back at embedded reporters going back to, like, Ernie Pyle in World War II, and he wasn't necessarily a cheerleader, but he certainly was with the troops a great deal.
It was a very different era. Yeah.
How much difference between the you were doing television reporting up to the time of your injury.
And I was doing television reporting until a year and a half ago and then switched back to print, which I'd come from.
Okay. Well, how much of a difference is there between what you look for in a story as a print reporter and what you look for as a television reporter?
Television, you're looking for something, you're looking for a character, an image that will make the audience stop and take notice, and a story that is simple enough to tell in a minute and a half or a 2 or 3 minute package. Then it's sort of, I kind of liken it to writing a haiku, which is, you know, a short 3-line poem versus a sonnet, which can go on for pages or the entire length of a book. One is more you're grabbing an impression and trying to teach the American public this is how it is in the field in a way that will sear into their brains and will stay with them. In print, you get the luxury of I can sit down with a top general and really get their thoughts. I got to sit down with General Mulholland a while back and talk about what it was like commanding the guys who were going into Afghanistan with no support, no backup in 2001, the combined Special Forces CIA operation there. And so you could really answer my questions for an hour, and then I could do it justice with a good long article. So you're coming from different angles when you're looking at some of that stuff. But one thing that I have to stress is not being a cheerleader, that also doesn't mean that I stopped being an American as a reporter. When Ernie Pyle was in the field, he would often hold back on things, that whole generation would hold back on things that might, quote-unquote, damage morale back in the States. There's less of that now. I will hold back on things, say, if I find out a piece of information about a terrorist subject in Yemen, and I know that through intelligence sources that the U.S. is about to target someone, I obviously can't report that because sometimes the organizations that I report on, be they the CIA, be they the Pentagon, you know, I will say, I found out this, this, and this, and they will reach out to me and say, please, don't report that because that will reveal an imminent operation to the enemy. So as an American, you don't report that. As a responsible news organization, AP weighs that when we get those kind of requests. And on a regular basis, we hold things back. But unlike the Pyle generation, if we see something that might look a general, might make a commander look unflattering in the field, that we don't hold back.
I think, Kim, three examples, you know, I just came over the question and listened to that. I wanted to get your angle on is I'm sure you've run into the situation. I know that when they train our general officers and our flag officers, they talk about the delicate relationship that there is between, you know, people in their positions of authority and a journalist. They both have different charters, and you have distinctly different responsibilities. And the danger that can be when you get a little too close and you get a little too comfortable. And three cases I can think of off the top of my head is there was Admiral Fox Fallon out at CENTCOM and his interview with PM Barnett, who's not technically a journalist. He's just a writer occasionally. Then there was General McChrystal and that train wreck of a Rolling Stone article. And more recently, there was Major General Fuller, who was relieved by General Allen out in Afghanistan for the comments he made about President Karzai. How do things like that happen where you see these general officers and flag officers seem to not appreciate who they're actually talking to? Is it the fact that they just get very comfortable, they're caught at a bad moment, or what is it that can make somebody do what seems to be such an amateur error?
Not having been present for any of those interviews, I can't get in the heads of those who decided to trust those journalists or say those things. That there's at least one of the cases that you mentioned with General McChrystal, there is an argument over whether the journalists honored the off-the-record rules. And so that becomes a he said, she said, which is extremely uncomfortable. In General Fuller's case, as I understand it, these were opinions that he held and decided to express. And his superiors decided that he couldn't continue doing the job he was doing, which required cooperating with Afghans after having so publicly insulted them. That said, more senior people than him have insulted Karzai and his ilk on the record to major news organizations. So I don't know. Did General Fuller think that because he'd heard the superiors say the same thing that he could echo that? I haven't. I don't know the man, and I would be interested to ask him at some point. But here's the deal. Each journalist you come across is an individual. Everyone you hear, if you're troops in the field and you hear a journalist is going to come be embedded with you or going to sit down with you, if you're general officer or, you know, 0405, Google them or ask your press officer, what's the story on this person? I try, when I give military media talks, I tell folks, look, there's this wide gap between the American public and the U.S. military. Talking to a reporter is your chance to narrow that gap. If you find out that the reporter you're about to talk to doesn't know your world very well, consider it a chance to teach them and educate them. Try not to be frustrated that they don't know your jargon and they don't have a clue about your daily life 24/7 or the sacrifices your families make with you in the field. This is a chance to teach them. At the same time, like any person that you're just meeting, you don't completely let your guard down. You have to build the trust. When I'm with people, especially because of the wounded with warrior experience that I've gone through, people often trust me very quickly, and I have to remind them, hey, by the way, we were sitting down for an interview. Is this stuff that you're telling me now, is it on the record? Is it off the record? Are you telling me this off the record for context? Are you telling me this on background? At the AP, if you say background, that means you and the person you're speaking to decide how you're going to anonymously source that person. Are they going to be a U.S. official? Are they going to be a senior military official? Are they going to be an administration official, meaning from the White House? I go through that checklist with people, and I flag them and remind them if they start talking without having vetted where this conversation's going to go. But every reporter I know, some reporters consider it a badge of honor if they can get someone talking without having established those ground rules. That happened to John Rizzo, the former CIA senior counsel, who was a key person in the drone program that's going on, that continues aimed at militants in the Pakistani tribal areas. Rizzo sat down with the journalist, didn't set the ground rules, so she decided it was all on the record. The article appeared in Newsweek. He's now being, I understand, investigated for revealing classified information because the information was attached to his name on the record. So it's just a cautionary tale. Reporters are an opportunity to spread the word to the public that doesn't know, but it's an opportunity that you got to treat with caution.
Well, I'm fascinated by what you said earlier about your somewhat lack of preparation. I don't want to say this the right way. It's not that you were ill-prepared for your embed, in 2006. Was that when you started?
I was living there. Go on.
Oh, I mean, as far as the military went, I was trying to find out, I guess my question really is, how did you end up there in May of 2006 in Baghdad with your camera team? How did your career develop, and how did you end up in that spot at that time?
Okay, well, I'll back up a bit. I was a CBS News correspondent based in Jerusalem, had been there for a few years prior to the war in Iraq, and ended up driving Dan Rather into Baghdad. The day Baghdad fell. We nearly got killed on the road in a few different times, a few different ways. We were unembedded and unarmed. It was one of those crazy things that journalists do, and some of us survived them. We did that day. I think partly out of respect and partly out of guilt, Dan Rather offered me the job in Baghdad as the mainstay correspondent covering the war that everyone at that time thought had ended. For me, I was at the time a pretty junior correspondent in 2003. I leapt at the chance. There wasn't so much happening in Jerusalem. The uprising had died down. And that's how I became the main person based there from 2003 to 2006, living in the red zone. I'd be in for 6 to 8 weeks, out for 1 to 2, back in for 6 to 8 weeks, embedding, doing short embeds because CBS needed me hammered to a rooftop live position most of the week. And I would get to know the troops in these short trips, these small doses. Occasionally I could get away for a week and spend serious time in the field with people. But I was coming into this as a foreign correspondent with expertise in the Middle East. I'd been based in Jerusalem covering the Middle East for years. I had been based in Egypt for 3 years. I'd covered Kosovo. I'd covered the riots in Northern Ireland. That was my background, not the U.S. military. But war came to our region. I'd been in Iraq several times under Saddam. So that's how I ended up there with the Middle East expertise, but not the expertise covering this war machine that descended on Iraq. And getting to know it, getting to learn it, I didn't have an anti-military bias. I'd grown up in a military family, but I didn't know what it was that I was about to cover. So that's what I meant by ignorance. And through the next 3 years covering that war, I not only learned about the U.S. military, but I learned about the American public through working, covering a war that divided this country like nothing I can remember in my lifetime. I don't know if you guys feel the same way. I think this left you all feeling pretty bitter and raw, especially in those early years.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. I have a slightly different outlook, but
take
I appreciate
on it. Yeah.
It.
But so when I had when I first got there, I started doing the rebuilding piece. You know, the story of troops going out to neighborhoods and rebuilding the water system, rebuilding the electric supply, and we put that on the air, and that's when I discovered American bloggers. My stories were denounced as, the most famous quote I heard, the one that stuck with me, was that I was a corporate pimp for George Bush's illegal war in Iraq. And I was like, wow, never thought of myself that way. Okay. Then the story changed. From the rebuilding story, it became a city and a country under siege from terrorist bombs and the battle back and forth between the Sunnis and the Shiites. The violence moved into the neighborhoods, and we would, when a bomb went off, before they started doing the 1-2s, like a small bomb to sucker people in and then a secondary explosion to kill more who came to rescue people, before they started doing that, when bombs would go off across Baghdad, we would run up to the roof, scan the horizon for smoke to see where it was, and then rush to the bomb scene. Get there with your camera, stick that in someone's, you know, I have this composite image of a screaming Iraqi father with his injured child screaming at me in broken English, what have you done to my country? You were supposed to bring security. And I put that on the air, just basically putting on the air what was happening in front of me. And now the right wing would jump in. One of the quotes was that I was a terrorist cheerleader, just by putting this stuff on the air, and that I was tearing down the efforts of our men and women in uniform. And I kind of went back and forth in my head as I would go over these scripts, like, okay, are you a corporate pimp or a terrorist cheerleader tonight? And it was heart-wrenching, and it was also maddening, because nobody was looking at the full body of my work. They were judging me by each minute and a half or 2 minutes that they'd see on the news that night. And they just assumed, especially from the military side of things, that anyone at CBS had an anti-military bias. it got to the point where my scripts were going through a fine-tooth comb with the editors back in New York who were just as worried as I was about the reaction, so that you'd strip it down to the bare bones to the point that it was like see spot run past the car bomb in Baghdad, Kimberly Dozier here, back to you. With that, though, something was happening back in the States. It was getting harder to get the story on the air. By the third year of the war, by then it was like 5 years into the war in Afghanistan as well, if you put stories on from either country in the first few minutes of your broadcast, people changed the channel. They didn't want to see. They didn't want to hear. And my bosses were beginning to question whether they should risk our lives letting us leave the Bureau to cover some of this stuff. And that's how we came to Memorial Day 2006. It was 4 months to the day after ABC News correspondent Bob Woodruff had been hit, and it was the first embed that the military had signed off on since Bob had been hit, and we were going to go out with troops. I talked to my camera crew, Paul Douglas and James Brolin, and they said, hey, you know, as we always told you, don't risk our life unless we're going to make air. And obviously, going out with the troops on Memorial Day, we're going to get on the early show, we're going to get on the evening news, we're going to be able to tell this story. It's worth taking the risk. And that's how we ended up on a Baghdad street with a patrol from the 4th Infantry Division and got hit by a bomb in the middle of what was supposed to be one of the safest districts in Baghdad. I guess they knew we were coming, and they command detonated a car bomb through our foot patrol.
Yeah, Kimberly, it's one of the things from the military side that, you know, kind of rubbed people the wrong way is sometimes it seems like the war reporting was something akin to local news where it bleeds, it leaves, but you never got the in-depth background. And I wanted to get your take on this is the one thing that a lot of people would talk about, because we wouldn't know this either directly or indirectly, where a friend of ours was injured. They've been medevaced to Landstuhl. You've got that background support network that is helping get in touch with their spouse or their family or their friends to make sure everybody knows. And there's these incredible things that you know in detail right now that go on in the background, people that lead out and help and try to get people organized. So just some great stories there that I think we're better at it now than we used to be. But it always seemed that there was never the second and third order examination of what went on afterwards in these events. And when you survived the attack in 2006, obviously, you know, the hierarchy of needs of survival and you know, making sure that you're in a position that you're going to go forward is primary. But at what point did the journalist in your head come out and go, I have an opportunity here to tell side of a story that for whatever reason doesn't get out there much? And it really sunk in. The reality you had every day was starting to communicate with your upper brain function as a professional journalist.
Well, I have to say what happened with the bomb blast that day, for a while, no, I wasn't a journalist. I was a victim. It was a long journey to being a survivor. Just to walk you through it, and the guys at the scene kept me alive, and later on, 6 months later, when I was finally back out of the hospital and learning to walk again, that's when I started writing things down. It eventually became a book, and the CBS News organization also did an hour-long special based on the 4th ID patrol and how this cut through their lives. So that was part of it later. But really, when you're in the middle of major trauma, if I could just walk you through a little of what happened that day.
Please.
It, you know, this was supposed to be a safe embed, a safe day. The guy we were with, Captain Alex Funkhauser, though he took a chance with us that I will always respect him for, because he could have just shown us. He was training Iraqis. And the story of the day was supposed to be, as they stand up, we stand down. And he was taking us to see Iraqi patrols that were taking over from Americans at various checkpoints in this Baghdad neighborhood called the Karada, where you saw the Marines pull down the statue at the beginning of the invasion. It was, though, the place we went first was where a roadside bomb had hit an Iraqi patrol the day before. And Captain Funkhauser told us, look, sometimes these guys are superstitious. They won't go back in an area. They won't show presence. We got to lead by example. So that's why we're going there first. And second reason, this is way before the media made a big brouhaha over counterinsurgency. Funkhauser knew this, as most of the troops I met knew instinctively. If you want to find out things from the people on the ground, you go talk to them in person. You let them know that you're there for them. And that's what Captain Funkhauser wanted to do. He said, I want to talk to the people on that street. They know who planted that roadside bomb. They won't lie to me face to face. That's how we ended up on this residential street with some cars parked along the side, parked our Humvees, and Captain Funkhauser saw that his translator had engaged a group of Iraqis in conversation. So he walked way ahead of me. I hung back because I saw Paul and James were near the translator and filming in his direction. I thought, great, they're going to get that shot. Funkhauser's going to walk up to the T-stand, reach out his hand, and the suspicious-looking Iraqis that I see looking in our direction, those looks are going to dissolve into the beginnings of smiles. I've seen it a dozen times before. It was right about the time when Captain Funkhauser reached out his hand that the insurgents command detonated an approximately 500-pound car bomb that was parked, say, 12, 15 feet from the T-stand. They detonated that, sending a wall of shrapnel through almost the entire patrol, through all of us. I woke up at the scene trying to figure out where Paul and James were. That was my team, and I knew an explosion had gone off, but I couldn't move, couldn't figure out exactly where I'd landed, and it was an Iowa National Guardsman who in the end ran into the scene, said I was the last person waiting for medical aid, and started tying the tourniquets on me that saved my life. They got us well after the golden hour, because there were five car bombs in Baghdad that day, a lot of QRFs, quick reaction forces, going to pick up a lot of different people. By the time they got us to the hospital, I had lost more than half my blood, and shrapnel to the brain, both femurs shattered, femoral artery cut, and studded with burning shrapnel from my hips to my ankles. They brought me back a number of times and got me to Longitude Regional Medical Center, like your friend, and that's where I woke up with my family around me. And that's when I started the journey on the other side, which is learning the whole military medical piece and how they put you back together. It was a three-month stay in the hospital, more than two dozen surgeries, lost count. They managed to save both of my legs and reconstruct the muscles that had been torn apart by the shrapnel and eventually teach me how to walk again. The military understood why I'd been in the field. That's why I'm glad I stayed at military medical hospitals, because a lot of civilians, as I was to discover later, when I got back on my feet and got to like a regular grocery store in the U.S., I'd run into people who'd recognize me, and they were just baffled by why I'd even want to be over there in a war zone. And I was a little bit dismayed and didn't quite know how to explain it at first. So for a while there, when I came out of rehab, the military here in the States, they were the only people who understood why the heck I'd been where I'd been, why my family wasn't mad at me for getting injured. They understood the drill, and why I wanted to go back. So that is a story that, as you say, yes, I agree with you. More of the American public needs to hear about that story, and I've spent the past 5 years telling it over and over and over again. Now, if I had not been embedded that day, you know, I've probably reached between 30 and 40 million people with this story. Think about the power of that, the people taking a chance on me, trusting me to have them along that day, and hopefully, I hope, it's accomplished some good.
Well, I'm impressed with your story, and what you just said really struck home with me, because a lot of times, those of us who have been in the military or have children who are in the service, mm-hmm. when we mention that fact, or that they're deployed, the look from people who aren't in that position, who have no connection with the military, is as if we had just said our kid was juggling nitroglycerin on a high wire over the Grand Canyon. I mean, they have no concept.
Absolutely,
of what that's about, and it's I'm glad to hear that you got that, and I'm also glad to hear. I mean, the story of your rehabilitation is impressive. I'm also fascinated by what you wrote in that op-ed piece for the Washington Post about you don't have PTSD. You have something that you describe differently. Could you kind of talk about that?
Sure. One of the things, you know, The biggest part of my injury was physical and was also survivor's guilt. I lost Paul Douglas and James Brolin, my crew. Captain Funkhauser was killed. His translator was killed. I dealt with the angry families afterwards, who are angry with anyone who survives. That's part of the grief process. But another part of what I went through was I had post-traumatic stress, not disorder, but post-traumatic stress. That means I had nightmares and flashbacks and hypervigilance, and my emotions were all over the map. Those are some of the symptoms. And I had it for approximately 3 weeks. Had those symptoms stayed with me longer than 4 to 6 weeks, then that's what you diagnose as a disorder, because that's basically your body uses those methods as a way to continue dealing with the trauma. What I did was, from the moment I opened my eyes up in Landstuhl, I asked for a piece of paper and a pen, and among the things I was trying to communicate with people was everything I could remember from the bomb scene. The same thing happened once that tube was out of my throat. I would talk to anyone who walked into my room, telling the story of all the last stuff I could remember. And anyone I came across from the patrol, I questioned them, where were they? I needed to forensically recreate the scene. Initially, when I got to Bethesda Naval Hospital, sorry, now it's Walter Reed, I know, but for me it'll always be Bethesda, Ward 5 East, I had a group of neurosurgeons, because of the shrapnel injury to my brain, who, together with my parents, kind of ganged up on me and said, we want you on antidepressants. We want you to stop watching news reports from Iraq. We want you to stop talking about the bombing. And I refused. You know, a woman in her 40s from the Oprah generation, I wanted to talk about this, and I wasn't going to get shut up. Eventually, it was a naval psychologist on his reserve duty who came in to my hospital room and said, so, I hear you're the one they can't shut up, that you want to talk about the incident. Well, guess what? You've found your person. I agree with you. Ignore them. Keep talking. Do what feels right to you. And he and I, over the next 3 weeks of my stay, talked at least an hour a day, several days a week. And within those 3 weeks, hey, this is what worked for me, the PTS symptoms went away. And I try to share that story with as many people as possible, because what Vic Huertas, my psychologist, said that I ended up with is something they call post-traumatic growth. And the majority of the people who come back from war zones, 80 to 90%, and eventually a lot of the people who have PTSD, they'll end up in the same space too. You get post-traumatic growth. You're more resilient. You're more adaptive. You have greater wisdom for dealing with crises in future because, heck, you've made decisions under fire. You've lived under stress maybe on a forward operating base for a year, never knowing when a mortar might come in, or you've been doing a patrol on an MSR route day after day for 360 out of 365 days. The skills you get from surviving that, learning how to survive that and keep your team together, that is valuable. And that's the kind of growth that the American public doesn't quite know about yet. So that's what I wrote about in the article, and that's also in the epilogue of the book, which they like to hand out to patients and caregivers at the hospitals because it's a pretty graphic description of what happened in the hospital, and then it's also, I'll talk about the stuff that most people are a little bit afraid to talk about out loud, because there's a stigma still.
Well, Kim, I tell you what, I'm so glad to hear you say that. And just a reminder for those who join us late, we're talking to journalist Kimberly Dozier. She's the author of Breathing the Fire, Fighting to Thrive, and Getting Back to the Fight. And proceeds go to benefit Wounded Warrior Charity, supporting injured troops. And anything they can do to get that out, I think the phrase, you know, the post-traumatic growth. I was somebody who left active duty 2 years ago, and one thing that I was not ready for is on more than one job interview, I had people who were very blunt and honest with me, who were worried about me simply because I spent over two decades in the military and had been spent some time in some interesting garden spots. To steal something from our British friends, it left me gobsmacked because there is a lot of bad mythology out there, I guess.
Yeah.
And there are people who have been through some tremendous challenges that there's a period, but the vast majority of them get through it and are strengthened by it. But there just seems to be this mythology out here that everybody is a broken vessel, and it's a horrible thing.
Exactly. And it's, for me, I was to discover that when I came back to work. You know, CBS News, wonderful place, people like family, but from the colleagues at work to strangers I'd meet on the street, everyone presumed I was some sort of walking PTSD time bomb. And I think we in the media are partly to blame. I mean, I did some of these stories in an attempt to get the folks who need help for their injuries, physical or mental, we, in a sense, painted the whole force with this brush. I also, if I see another NCIS episode where you've got somebody going crazy with a gun because of PTSD, I'm going to scream. It's just very frustrating that still people can't believe that you can go through something like that and be better for it. My dad survived the battles of Guam and Iwo Jima. He was one of two guys in his platoon to walk off the island. He turned down his Purple Heart because he didn't think he was injured badly enough. And then he kicked himself for his pride when he found out his young wife and mother back home would have gotten an extra like $5 a week for it. So he's like, yep, don't be proud. I was proud. Don't be proud. But when he got back from war, people wanted to hire him and his generation because they were, you know, they'd been made men by war. How have we come from that to this?
I
know I pose a question after being telling you it's the media's fault and I'm a member of the media, but still.
Well, I think it's more than that. I think it's something that you have to fix with the media. And I think a lot of people have issues with reporting for whatever reason. I think we'd be better off getting closer to each other, we being the military and the journalist, because when you look also in the broader media ecosystem, if you want to throw in Hollywood in there, the unmitigated garbage, you mentioned CSI, that's another, you know, there are tons of television shows that do that. Movies is back. My co-host, and I'm a Gen Xer, but my co-host is a Vietnam-era veteran. He saw what was smeared. I'm a big fan of the book by B.G. Burkitt's Stolen Valor that I think really outlines what was done to the Vietnam generation. But I think that the best way that you attack bad knowledge is by giving people the opportunity to learn. And I think your book and the information that you're putting out is an essential part of that. Eagle One, I think I stole your question.
Well, that's all right, because I was going to go pontificating about the fact that some people continue to refer to the people who have joined the military as kids. You know, we put our kids into battle and all that, and that image just drives me insane. These are not kids. These are young men and women who may be young, but, you know, they're not going to, as the book Catch 22 points out, when people are shooting at you, it's hard to get much older. I mean, you can die at any second. And it's a very maturing experience, and they deserve an immense amount of respect, which they do not get. So I appreciate what you're saying greatly, especially as one of those crazed Vietnam veterans that at any minute may run amok in a shopping mall. So,
well, the scary thing is I was at the Iraq and Afghan Veterans for America get-together last week for Veterans Day, and one of the figures that they said on stage just stop the whole audience cold, is that in some parts of this country, the unemployment among veterans is at 30% compared to the national average of around just under 10%. It's just astounding that somebody could come back with those skills. And I understand there's a transition process, but I think there's something else going on with the American public that they automatically tend not to want to hire these people. And Sal, I guess if the work experience, the interview experience you mentioned, that's one of the best anecdotes I've heard that could explain what's going on.
It is. It's very real. And politics is kind of neutral in this, but I'm in a very red part of the country too. So I can imagine other parts of the country that I can live in that perhaps aren't as pro-military as this. I can imagine those veterans are running into what I'm running into in an even greater extent. And I think a lot of it has to do with ignorance, and that ignorance comes from the fact that where they're getting their information is what they see on the TV and the movies, and it's a hell of a headwind for people to push through, and many of them wind up like me going and working for themselves.
And the sad thing is, though, that it was done out of the, like, goodness of people's hearts. And I remember that the pieces that I put on the air about a young medic who came back with PTSD and he could not get it recognized, could not get it diagnosed, and was being chaptered out of the military after having risked his life and ended up with this injury. So I know initially, you know, it's like turning a huge ship. The education went in one direction. Now it's got to go in another direction. What I'm not so sure about is how you bridge the divide between the general public and the fewer than 1% who serve currently in uniform and the fewer than 5% who know someone in uniform. I know Hollywood's got to be a major way. We just have to, and journalists are another way. You just have to keep the outreach going, because that's one of the only ways, I think, to knit things together.
Exactly.
But I'm open to suggestion, and I'm a member of the media. So if anyone's listening with suggestions, open fire.
You go on.
Well, I think we just have to keep talking about it. I mean, it's a problem that exists, and we have to acknowledge it and then discuss it. I don't think it helps to keep offering I'm sorry for interrupting your time here, but it's like we're giving gifts to our veterans, let's help the veterans get employed. I think that's an important program, but it's got to not be treated as this is another class of victims that we need to help. These are not victims. Just as you say, you're not a victim because of your injury during the war. You're a survivor, or you've moved on to some other part of your life. But victimhood is not the right word for these kids, for these young men and women.
No, don't put people on the
floor. And my question, I guess, is you've got this new assignment with AP, and I kind of want to get into that.
Ah.
What are you doing with Afghanistan and Pakistan and all these wonderful things?
Well, let me briefly describe how I got there, because that's a fun evolution, and it's all thanks to Admiral, well, a lot of it's thanks to Admiral Mike Mullen. I was working at CBS News and kept asking to travel back overseas, and they kept saying, no, no, we need you to do this thing at the White House. No, no, we need you to do this thing at the Pentagon. And they wouldn't level with me until Admiral Mullen invited me on his USO tour back to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now. And that smoked CBS out. They finally said, we'll never let you go back to anywhere where you might get injured again. And it was just like flashing back to my mom and dad at Bethesda Naval Hospital. One of these things that can happen is your loved ones initially are crucial to keep you going through the process, help you make decisions while you're on all these different painkillers and you can barely think straight. But healing is pain. And about halfway through my stay at Bethesda, mom wanted the physiotherapists to stop coming in. Just the same way she wanted me to go on antidepressants so that I would stop crying every morning when I realized where I was and that I didn't know if I'd ever walk again. So, yes, now I'm running. I'm fine. They do great work at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Okay, but I digress. My parents initially had trouble with me going back to the field. So did CBS. So I went with Mike Mullen as a private citizen. He took me as, you know, Kimberly Dozier author, and got back, got out my resume, and found that the Associated Press is one of those organizations that's got 30 different people who've been injured in war zones back in the field. Our head of photos and our head of foreign affairs have both been injured in conflicts in the past and went back. So didn't have to make an argument there. And that's how I ended up. AP had this job open covering intelligence and counterterrorism, which has really evolved. It's the way the fight has evolved. It's intelligence and special operations. And just to be quite honest, when AP first asked me, so do you have a lot of contacts in the intelligence world? I lied through my teeth and said, absolutely. I knew nothing. And I had no idea what I was about to cover. So it has been, the first 6 months were terrifying, and a lot of my old friends in the military from Iraq and then new friends I'd made through the special operations world, thanks to Wounded Warrior events, a lot of very kind people basically sat me down and said, okay, here's a book you need to read. Here's another book you need to read. Let me tell you over lunch how this system works. And it's been, you know, like a lot of folks who deploy to a new country, that first year was drinking from the fire hose all the time. But in the end, I started breaking stories, keeping up with the big boys in terms of, you know, breaking stories that matched or beat the Washington Post and the New York Times. And I know that this upset some people, but I did break the Navy SEAL part of the Osama bin Laden raid. But hey, Biden and Panetta confirmed it on record within 48 hours of my story. So, you know.
That was very nice. I had a little row back and forth with my service as well. My take was the word is going to get out anyway. You're not going to be able to bottle this genie, so you might as well deliver it correctly. But good for you for jumping on the AP opportunity. I can't stand anybody patronizing an adult in any way, shape, or form. I can know exactly how you're feeling towards CBS. Get anybody standard up.
I mean, I understand, but I know where they were coming from.
Sure.
They just, you know, like a loving family that just can't let go. But I wish I'd been able to hear Admiral Mullen's call to my boss saying, I'm going to take her as a private citizen anyway, damn it. So
I will give Admiral Mullen a nod there. And I don't think you were lying so much as you were being aggressively optimistic, so to speak.
There you go, exactly. I knew a couple people.
And
I met Mike Hayden once.
You'll appreciate this, having had to fight people trying to put antidepressants on you. A friend of mine, she was put on antidepressants, and about 3 weeks later, she went to her doctor and said, I want off these. And like, why? She said, I want my anger back. I need my anger. I'm not doing what I need to do if I'm not angry. He took her off.
Yes, anger can be an energy, absolutely.
Absolutely. And I wanted to, God, we're running out of time so fast, but you have a lot of experience and a lot invested in what happened in Iraq and the Iraq story. Again, a four-hour answer in a couple of minutes. But with the announcement of the 31 December withdrawal from Iraq, as you know, either as a journalist or just as an individual, whichever you're more comfortable with, what are your thoughts and impressions on that?
As a journalist and a watcher of the Middle East, I would say the good thing is this is an Iraqi decision by an Iraqi government. They are independent, and this shows their independence. As an American concern and an individual concerned about security in the region, I guess my personal fear is that, you know, I thought we were going to have a small lattice work of special operations forces working with the Iraqis, helping them with intelligence and logistics, not leading the way, but just there to keep things on an even keel. I am worried. I'm worried for my Iraqi friends. I'm worried for, you know, just the lives and treasure we spent there. So that's in the back of my mind. At the same time, hey, this is their choice. This is their call. And I also have some friends on the ground there who are still trying to negotiate a skeleton crew. So, you know, good on them, and hopefully we'll come up with something that both countries can live with.
What have you got coming up, and any plugs you want to make for Wounded Warriors or anybody else that as we wrap this up?
Well, you know, I do a lot of work for Fisher House, and there's another organization called Team Red, White, and Blue. If anyone in the military has heard of them, they are back here. It's run by a young Army major. They run races and raise money to fund their other part of their operation, which is to find families in countries across the United States, all 50 states, they don't have them all covered yet, where they'll pair a wounded warrior or returning veteran with a local family. So they've got someone to go to beer with, someone to call and say, hey, I'm an amputee and I can't cut my lawn. Can you help me find someone to cut the lawn? Kind of a big brother, big sister program for returning wounded warriors. So, yeah, Team Red, White, and Blue, shout out to them. And also, of course, the local Norfolk charity, Wounded Wear. You can go to woundedwear.org. They've got a number of events that they have year-round, especially some races. And sorry, Jay, I don't have the latest race in my head, but if they go to woundedwear.org, they will be able to find it.
Kimberly, thank you very much for lining all that up at the end. I just want to remind everybody, our guest has been Kimberly Dozier. She's the author of Breathing the Fire, Fighting to Survive, and Getting Back to the Fight, which we now have in paperback, so there's no excuse.
Sorry.
And again,
and ebook. You can find more about it at KimberlyDozier.com.
And audiobook.
Perfect.
And an audiobook, which I read, 8 hours of my voice. It's kind of scary.
Well, you and Secretary Rumsfeld reading themselves. Congratulations on that. I know that's a lot of hard work, and as somebody who listens to it, it's always great to hear the author read their own book because I do audiobooks a lot because I spend a lot of time in the car. You hear the inflection in the voice of the person who told the story, and that gives so much depth to what you're reading. So I think you've done your listenership and your readership a great service by reading it yourself.
Well, it's been great talking to you guys, and I hope for folks coming back from the field, and just one other thing I'd love to say is talk to your loved one. Try to find a way to let them know what you've been seeing in the field, because they're stronger than you think, and that'll help you guys go forward together.
Thank you, Kim, very much. Enjoyed it.
Thank you, Kim, very much. And I want to thank everybody who joined us today, and we hope to see you again next week for another episode of Midrash.
and friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly.